The Gift of Strawberries. I once heard Ivan Peter, a Gwich'in man, a father, a husband, an environmental activist, and chief of Arctic Village, a small village in northeastern Alaska, introduce himself simply as a boy who was raised by a river, a description as smooth and slippery as a river rock. Did he mean only that he grew up near its banks? Or was the river responsible for rearing him, for teaching him the things he needed to live? Did it feed him, body and soul? Raised by a river. I suppose both meanings are true. You can scarcely have one without the other. In a way, I was raised by strawberries, fields of them. Not to exclude the maples, hemlocks, white pine, goldenrod, asters, violets, and mosses of upstate New York. But it was the wild strawberries, beneath dewy leaves on an almost summer morning, who gave me my sense of the world, my place in it. Behind our house were miles of old hay fields, divided by stone walls, long abandoned from farming, but not yet grown up to forest. After the school bus chugged up our hill, I'd throw down my red plaid book bag, change my clothes before my mother could think of a chore, and jump across the creek to go wandering in the goldenrod. Our mental maps had all the landmarks we kids needed: the fort under the sumacs, the rock pile, the river, the big pine with branches so evenly spaced you could climb to the top as if it were a ladder, and the strawberry patches. White petals with a yellow center, like a little wild rose, they dotted the acres of curl grass in May during the flower moon, Wabigiwanagesis. We kept good track of them, peeking under the trifoliate leaves to check their progress as we ran through on our way to catch frogs. After the flower finally dropped its petals, a tiny green nub appeared in its place, and as the days got longer and warmer, it swelled to a small white berry. These were sour, but we ate them anyway, impatient for the real thing. You could smell ripe strawberries before you saw them, the fragrance mingling with the smell of sun on damp ground. It was the smell of June, the last day of school, when we were set free, and the strawberry moon, O Deimenikesis. I'd lie on my stomach in my favorite patches, watching the berries grow sweeter and bigger under the leaves. Each tiny wild berry was scarcely bigger than a raindrop, dimpled with seeds under the cap of leaves. From that vantage point, I could pick only the reddest of the red, leaving the pink ones for tomorrow. Even now, after more than 50 strawberry moons, finding a patch of wild strawberries still touches me with a sensation of surprise, a feeling of unworthiness and gratitude for the generosity and kindness that comes with an unexpected gift, all wrapped in red and green. Really? For me? Oh, you shouldn't have. After 50 years, they still raise the question of how to respond to their generosity. Sometimes it feels like a silly question with a very simple answer. Eat them. But I know that someone else has wondered these same things. In our creation stories, the origin of strawberries is important. Sky Woman's beautiful daughter, whom she carried in her womb from Sky World, grew on the good green earth, loving and loved by all the other beings. But tragedy befell her when she died giving birth to her twins, Flint and Sapling. Heartbroken, Sky Woman buried her beloved daughter in the earth. Her final gifts, our most revered plants, grew from her body. The strawberry arose from her heart. In Potawatomi, the strawberry is Odeyamin, the heartberry. We recognize them as the leader of the berries, the first to bear fruit. Strawberries first shaped my view of a world full of gifts simply scattered at your feet. A gift comes to you through no action of your own. It's free, having moved toward you without your beckoning. It's not a reward. You cannot earn it or call it to you or even deserve it. And yet it appears. Your only role is to be open-eyed and present. Gifts exist in a realm of humility and mystery. As with random acts of kindness, we do not know their source. Those fields of my childhood showered us with strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, hickory nuts in the fall, bouquets of wildflowers brought to my mom, and family walks on Sunday afternoon. They were our playground, retreat, wildlife sanctuary, ecology classroom, and the place where we learned to shoot tin cans off the stone wall. All for free. Or so I thought. I experienced the world in that time as a gift economy. Goods and services not purchased, but received as gifts from the earth. Of course, I was blissfully unaware of how my parents must have struggled to make ends meet in the wage economy, raging far from this field. In our family, the presents we gave one another were almost always homemade. I thought that was the definition of a gift, something you made for someone else. We made all our Christmas gifts, piggy banks from old Clorox bottles, hot pads from broken clothespins, and puppets from retired socks. My mother says it was because we had no money for store-bought presents. It didn't seem like a hardship to me. It was something special. My father loves wild strawberries, and so for Father's Day, my mother would almost always make him strawberry shortcake. She baked the crusty shortcakes and whipped a heavy cream, but we kids were responsible for the berries. We each got an old jar or two and spent the Saturday before the celebration out in the fields, taking forever to fill them as more and more berries ended up in our mouths. Finally, we returned home and poured them out on the kitchen table to sort out the bugs. I'm sure we missed some, but Dad never mentioned the extra protein. In fact, he thought wild strawberry shortcake was the best possible present, or so he had us convinced. It was a gift that could never be bought. As children raised by strawberries, we were probably unaware that the gift of berries was from the fields themselves, not from us. Our gift was time and attention and care and red-stained fingers. Heartberries, indeed. Gifts from the earth or from each other establish a particular relationship, an obligation of sorts, to give, to receive, and to reciprocate. The field gave to us, we gave to my dad, and we tried to give back to the strawberries. When the berry season was done, the plants would send out slender red runners to make new plants. Because I was fascinated by the way they would travel over the ground looking for good places to take root, I would weed out little patches of bare ground where the runners touched down. Sure enough, tiny little roots would emerge from the runner, and by the end of the season, there were even more plants, ready to bloom under the next strawberry moon. No person taught us this. The strawberries showed us. Because they had given us a gift, an ongoing relationship opened between us. Farmers around us grew a lot of strawberries and frequently hired kids to pick for them. My siblings and I would ride our bikes a long way to Crandall's farm to pick berries to earn spending money. A dime for every quart we picked. But Mrs. Crandall was a persnickety overseer. She stood at the edge of the field in her bib apron and instructed us how to pick and warned us not to crush any berries. She had other rules, too. These berries belong to me, she said, not to you. I don't want to see you kids eating my berries. I knew the difference. In the fields behind my house, the berries belonged to themselves. At this lady's roadside stand, she sold them for 60 cents a quart. It was quite a lesson in economics. We'd have to spend most of our wages if we wanted to ride home with berries in our bike baskets. Of course, those berries were 10 times bigger than our wild ones, but not nearly so good. I don't believe we ever put those farm berries in Dad's shortcake. It wouldn't have felt right. It's funny how the nature of an object, let's say a strawberry or a pair of socks, is so changed by the way it comes into your hands, as a gift or as a commodity. The pair of wool socks that I buy at the store, red and gray striped, are warm and cozy. I might feel grateful for the sheep that made the wool and the worker who ran the knitting machine. I hope so. but I have no inherent obligation to those socks as a commodity, as private property. There is no bond beyond the politely exchanged thank yous with the clerk. I've paid for them, and our reciprocity ended the minute I handed her the money. The exchange ends once parity has been established, an equal exchange. They become my property. I don't write a thank you note to J.C. Penney. But what if those very same socks, red and gray striped, were knitted by my grandmother and given to me as a gift? That changes everything. A gift creates ongoing relationship. I will write a thank you note. I will take good care of them. And if I'm a very gracious grandchild, I'll wear them when she visits, even if I don't like them. When it's her birthday, I will surely make her a gift in return. As the scholar and writer Lewis Hyde notes, it is the cardinal difference between gift and commodity exchange that a gift establishes a feeling bond between two people. Wild strawberries fit the definition of gift, but grocery store berries do not. It's the relationship between producer and consumer that changes everything. As a gift thinker, I would be deeply offended if I saw wild strawberries in the grocery store. I would want to kidnap them all. They were not meant to be sold, only to be given. Hyde reminds us that in a gift economy, one's freely given gifts cannot be made into someone else's capital. I can see the headline now. Woman arrested for shoplifting produce. Strawberry Liberation Front claims responsibility. This is the same reason we do not sell sweetgrass. Because it's given to us, it should only be given to others. My dear friend Wally Bear Michigo is a ceremonial firekeeper for our people and uses a lot of sweetgrass on our behalf. There are folks who pick for him in a good way to keep him supplied. But even so, at a big gathering, sometimes he runs out. At powwows and fairs, you can see our own people selling sweetgrass for $10 a braid. When Wally really needs Wingoshk for a ceremony, he may visit one of those booths among the stalls, selling fry bread or hanks of beads. He introduces himself to the seller, explains his need, just as he would in a meadow, asking permission of the sweetgrass. He cannot pay for it, not because he doesn't have the money, but because it cannot be bought or sold and still retain its essence for ceremony. He expects sellers to graciously give him what he needs, but sometimes they don't. The guy at the booth thinks he's being shaken down by an elder. "Hey, you can't get something for nothing," he says. But that is exactly the point. A gift is something for nothing, except that certain obligations are attached. For the plant to be sacred, it cannot be sold. Reluctant entrepreneurs will get a teaching from Wally, but they'll never get his money. Sweetgrass belongs to Mother Earth. Sweetgrass pickers collect properly and respectfully for their own use and needs of their community. They return a gift to the earth and tend to the well-being of the Wingoshk. The braids are given as gifts to honor, to say thank you, to heal, and to strengthen. Sweetgrass is kept in motion. When Wally gives sweetgrass to the fire, it is a gift that has passed from hand to hand, growing richer as it is honored in every exchange. That is the fundamental nature of gifts. They move, and their value increases with their passage. The fields made a gift of berries to us, and we made a gift of them to our Father. The more something is shared, the greater its value becomes. This is hard to grasp for societies steeped in notions of private property, where others are, by definition, excluded from sharing. Practices such as posting land against trespass, for example, are expected and accepted in a property economy, but are unacceptable in an economy where land is seen as a gift to all. Lewis Hyde wonderfully illustrates this dissonance in his exploration of the Indian giver. This expression, used negatively today as a pejorative for someone who gives something and then wants to have it back actually derives from a fascinating cross-cultural misinterpretation between an indigenous culture operating in a gift economy and a colonial culture predicated on the concept of private property. When gifts were given to the settlers by the native inhabitants, the recipients understood that they were valuable and were intended to be retained. Giving them away would have been an affront. But the indigenous people understood the value of the gift to be based in reciprocity and would be affronted if the gifts did not circulate back to them. Many of our ancient teachings counsel that whatever we have been given is supposed to be given away again. From the viewpoint of a private property economy, the gift is deemed to be free because we obtain it free of charge at no cost. But in the gift economy, gifts are not free. The essence of the gift is that it creates a set of relationships. The currency of a gift economy is at its root reciprocity. In Western thinking, private land is understood to be a bundle of rights, whereas in a gift economy, property has a bundle of responsibilities attached. I was once lucky enough to spend time doing ecological research in the Andes. My favorite part was market day at the local village when the square filled with vendors. There were tables loaded with plátanos, carts of fresh papaya, stalls in bright colors with pyramids of tomatoes, and buckets of hairy yucca roots. Other vendors spread blankets on the ground with everything you could need, from flip-flops to woven palm hats. Squatting behind her red blanket, a woman in a striped shawl and navy blue bowler spread out medicinal roots as beautifully wrinkled as she was. The colors, the smells of corn roasting on a wood fire, and sharp limes, and the sounds of all the voices mingle wonderfully in my memory. I had a favorite stall where the owner, Edita, looked for me each day. She'd kindly explain how to cook unfamiliar items and pull out the sweetest pineapple she'd been saving under the table. And once she even had strawberries. I know I paid the gringa prices, but the experience of abundance and goodwill were worth every peso. I dreamed not long ago of that market, with all its vivid textures. I walked through the stalls with a basket over my arm, and as always, went right to Edita for a bunch of fresh cilantro. We chatted and laughed, and when I held up my coins, she waved them off, patting my arm and sending me away. "A gift," she said. "Muchas gracias, señora," I replied. There was my favorite panadera, with clean cloths laid over the round loaves. I chose a few rolls, opened my purse, and this vendor, too, gestured away my money, as if I were impolite to suggest paying. I looked around in bewilderment. This was my familiar market, and yet everything had changed. And it wasn't just for me. No shopper was paying. I floated through the market with a sense of euphoria. Gratitude was the only currency accepted here. It was all a gift. It was like picking strawberries in my field. The merchants were just intermediaries, passing on gifts from the earth. I looked in my basket. 2 zucchinis, an onion, tomatoes, bread, and a bunch of cilantro. It was still half empty, but it felt full. I had everything I needed. I glanced over at the cheese stall, thinking to get some, but knowing it would be given, not sold, I decided I could do without. It's funny. Had all the things in the market merely been a very low price, I probably would have scooped up as much as I could. But when everything became a gift, I felt self-restraint. I didn't want to take too much. And I began thinking of what small presents I might bring to the vendors tomorrow. The dream faded, of course, but the feelings, first of euphoria and then of self-restraint, remain. I've thought of it often and recognize now that I was witness there to the conversion of a market economy to a gift economy, from private goods to common wealth. And in that transformation, the relationships became as nourishing as the food I was getting. Across the market stalls and blankets, warmth and compassion were changing hands. There was a shared celebration of abundance for all we'd been given. And since every market basket contained a meal, there was justice. I'm a plant scientist, and I want to be clear. But I'm also a poet, and the world speaks to me in metaphor. When I speak of the gift of berries, I do not mean that Fragaria virginiana has been up all night making a present just for me, strategizing to find exactly what I'd like on a summer morning. So far as we know, that does not happen. But as a scientist, I'm well aware of how little we do know. The plant has in fact been up all night, assembling little packets of sugar and seeds and fragrance and color, because when it does so, its evolutionary fitness is increased. When it is successful in enticing an animal such as me to disperse its fruit, its genes for making yumminess are passed on to ensuing generations with a higher frequency than those of the plant whose berries were inferior. The berries made by the plant shape the behaviors of the dispersers and have adaptive consequences. What I mean, of course, is that our human relationship with strawberries is transformed by our choice of perspective. It is human perception that makes the world a gift. When we view the world this way, strawberries and humans alike are transformed. The relationship of gratitude and reciprocity thus developed can increase the evolutionary fitness of both plant and animal. A species and a culture that treat the natural world with respect and reciprocity will surely pass on genes to ensuing generations with a higher frequency than the people who destroy it. The stories we choose to shape our behaviors have adaptive consequences. Lewis Hyde has made extensive studies of gift economies. He finds that objects will remain plentiful because they are treated as gifts. A gift relationship with nature is a formal give and take that acknowledges our participation in and dependence upon natural increase. We tend to respond to nature as a part of ourselves, not a stranger or alien available for exploitation. Gift exchange is the commerce of choice, for it is commerce that harmonizes with or participates in the process of nature's increase. In the old times, when people's lives were so directly tied to the land, it was easy to know the world as gift. When fall came, the skies would darken with flocks of geese, honking, "Here we are!" It reminds the people of the creation story, when the geese came to save Sky Woman. The people are hungry, winter is coming, and the geese fill the marshes with food. It is a gift, and the people receive it with thanksgiving, love, and respect. But when the food does not come from a flock in the sky, when you don't feel the warm feathers cool in your hand, and know that a life has been given for yours, when there is no gratitude in return, that food may not satisfy. It may leave the spirit hungry while the belly is full. Something is broken when the food comes on a styrofoam tray wrapped in slippery plastic, a carcass of a being whose only chance at life was a cramped cage. That is not a gift of life. It's a theft. How in our modern world can we find our way to understand the earth as a gift again, to make our relations with the world sacred again? I know we cannot all become hunter-gatherers. The living world could not bear our weight. But even in a market economy, can we behave as if the living world were a gift? We could start by listening to Wally. There are those who will try to sell the gifts. But as Wally says of sweetgrass for sale, don't buy it. Refusal to participate is a moral choice. Water is a gift for all, not meant to be bought and sold. Don't buy it. When food has been wrenched from the earth, depleting the soil, and poisoning our relatives in the name of higher yields, don't buy it. In material fact, strawberries belong only to themselves. The exchange relationships we choose determine whether we share them as a common gift or sell them as a private commodity. A great deal rests on that choice. For the greater part of human history, and in places in the world today, common resources were the rule. But someone invented a different story, a social construct in which everything is a commodity to be bought and sold. The market economy story has spread like wildfire, with uneven results for human well-being and devastation for the natural world. But it is just a story we have told ourselves, and we are free to tell another, to reclaim the old one. One of these stories sustains the living systems on which we depend. One of these stories opens the way to living in gratitude and amazement at the richness and generosity of the world. One of these stories asks us to bestow our own gifts in kind, to celebrate our kinship with the world. We can choose. If all the world is a commodity, how poor we grow. When all the world is a gift in motion, how wealthy we become. In those childhood fields waiting for strawberries to ripen, I used to eat the sour white ones, sometimes out of hunger, but mostly from impatience. I knew the long-term results of my short-term greed, but I took them anyway. Fortunately, our capacity for self-restraint grows and develops like the berries beneath the leaves, so I learned to wait a little. I remember lying on my back in the fields, watching the clouds go by, and rolling over to check the berries every few minutes. When I was young, I thought the change might happen that fast. Now I am old, and I know that transformation is slow. The commodity economy has been here on Turtle Island for 400 years, eating up the white strawberries and everything else. But people have grown weary of the sour taste in their mouths. A great longing is upon us to live again in a world made of gifts. I can scent it coming, like the fragrance of ripening strawberries rising on the breeze. An offering. Our people were canoe people, until they made us walk, until our lakeshore lodges were signed away for shanties and dust. Our people were a circle until we were dispersed. Our people shared a language with which to thank the day until they made us forget. But we didn't forget. Not quite. Most summer mornings of childhood, I woke to the sound of the outhouse door, the squeak of the hinge followed by the hollow thunk as it shut. I rose to consciousness through the hazy songs of vireos and thrushes, the lapping of the lake, and finally the sound of my father pumping the tank on the Coleman stove. By the time my brothers and sisters and I emerged from our sleeping bags, the sun would be just topping the eastern shore, pulling mist off the lake in long white coils. The small four-cup coffee pot of battered aluminum, blackened with the smoke of many fires, would already be thumping. Our family spent summers canoe camping in the Adirondacks, and every day began this way. I can picture my father, in his red-checked wool shirt, standing atop the rocks above the lake. When he lifts the coffee pot from the stove, the morning bustle stops. We know without being told that it's time to pay attention. He stands at the edge of camp with the coffee pot in his hands, holding the top in place with a folded pot holder. He pours coffee out on the ground in a thick brown stream. The sunlight catches the flow, striping it amber and brown and black as it falls to the earth and steams in the cool morning air. With his face to the morning sun, he pours and speaks into the stillness. Here's to the gods of Tahoas. The stream runs down over smooth granite to merge with the lake water, as clear and brown as the coffee. I watch it trickle, picking up bits of pale lichen and soaking a tiny clump of moss as it follows a crack to the water's edge. The moss swells with the liquid and unfurls its leaves to the sun. Then, and only then, does he pour out steaming cups of coffee for himself and for my mother, who stands at the stove making pancakes. So begins each morning in the North Woods, the words that come before all else. I was pretty sure that no other family I knew began their day like this, but I never questioned the source of those words, and my father never explained. They were just part of our life among the lakes. But their rhythm made me feel at home, and the ceremony drew a circle around our family. By those words, we said, "Here we are." And I imagined that the land heard us, murmured to itself, "Oh, here are the ones who know how to say thank you." Tahoas is the Algonquin name for Mount Marcy, the highest peak in the Adirondacks. It's called Mount Marcy to commemorate a governor who never set foot on those wild slopes. Tahoas, the cloud splitter, is its true name, invoking its essential nature. Among our Potawatomi people, there are public names and true names. True names are used only by intimates and in ceremony. My father had been on Tahoas' summit many times and knew it well enough to call it by name, speaking with intimate knowledge of the place and the people who came before. When we call a place by name, it is transformed from wilderness to homeland. I imagine that this beloved place knew my true name as well, even when I myself did not. Sometimes my father would name the gods of Forked Lake, or South Pond, or Brandybrook Flow, wherever our tents were settled for the night. I came to know that each place was inspirited, was home to others before we arrived and long after we left. As he called out the names and offered a gift, the first coffee, he quietly taught us the respect we owed these other beings and how to show our thanks for summer mornings. I knew that in the long-ago times, our people raised their thanks in morning songs, in prayer, and the offering of sacred tobacco. But at that time, in our family history, we didn't have sacred tobacco, and we didn't know the songs. They'd been taken away from my grandfather at the doors of the boarding school. But history moves in a circle. And here we were, the next generation, back to the loon-filled lakes of our ancestors, back to canoes. My mother had her own more pragmatic ritual of respect, the translation of reverence and intention into action. Before we paddled away from any camping place, she made us kids scour the place to be sure that it was spotless. No burnt matchstick, no scrap of paper escaped her notice. "Leave this place better than you found it," she admonished. And so we did, and we also had to leave wood for the next person's fire, with tinder and kindling carefully sheltered from rain by a sheet of birch bark. I like to imagine their pleasure, those other paddlers, arriving after dark to find a ready pile of fuel to warm their evening meal. My mother's ceremony connected us to them, too. The offering was made only under an open sky and never back in town where we lived. On Sundays, when other kids would go to church, my folks would take us out along the river to look for herons and muskrats, to the woods to hunt for spring flowers or on picnics. The words came along. For our winter picnics, we would walk all morning on snowshoes and then build a fire in the center of a circle stomped down with our webbed feet. This time the pot was full of bubbling tomato soup, and the first draft poured was for the snow. Here's to the gods of Tahoas. Only then would we wrap mittened hands around our steaming cups. And yet, As I grew to adolescence, the offering began to leave me angry or sad. The circle that had brought me a sense of belonging turned inside out. I heard in the words a message that we did not belong because we spoke in the language of exiles. It was a secondhand ceremony. Somewhere there were people who knew the right ceremony, who knew the lost language and spoke the true names, including my own. But still, every morning I watched the coffee disappear into the crumbly brown humus, as if returning to itself. In the same way that the flow of coffee down the rock opened the leaves of the moss, ceremony brought the quiescent back to life, opened my mind and heart to what I knew but had forgotten. The words and the coffee called us to remember that these woods and lakes were a gift. Ceremonies large and small have the power to focus attention to a way of living awake in the world. The visible became invisible, merging with the soil. It may have been a secondhand ceremony, but even through my confusion, I recognized that the earth drank it up as if it were right. The land knows you, even when you are lost. A people's story moves along like a canoe caught in the current, being carried closer and closer to where we had begun. As I grew up, my family found again the tribal connections that had been frayed but never broken by history. We found the people who knew our true names, and when I first heard in Oklahoma the sending of thanks to the four directions at the Sunrise Lodge, the offering in the old language of the sacred tobacco, I heard it as if in my father's voice. The language was different, but the heart was the same. Ours was a solitary ceremony, but fed from the same bond with the land, founded on respect and gratitude. Now the circle drawn around us is bigger, encompassing a whole people to which we again belong. But still the offering says, "Here we are." And still I hear at the end of the words the land murmuring to itself, "Oh, here are the ones who know how to say thank you." Today, my father can speak his prayer in our language. But it was, "Here's to the gods of Tahoas," that came first, in the voice that I will always hear. It was in the presence of the ancient ceremonies that I understood that our coffee offering was not secondhand. It was ours. Much of who I am and what I do is wrapped up in my father's offering by the lakeshore. Each day still begins with a version of "Here's to the gods of Tahoas," a thanksgiving for the day. My work as an ecologist, a writer, a mother, as a traveler between scientific and traditional ways of knowing, grows from the power of those words. It reminds me of who we are. It reminds me of our gifts and our responsibility to those gifts. Ceremony is a vehicle for belonging to a family, to a people, and to the land. At last, I thought that I understood the offerings to the gods of Tahoas. It was for me the one thing that was not forgotten, that which could not be taken by history, the knowing that we belonged to the land, that we were the people who knew how to say thank you. It welled up from a deep blood memory that the land, the lakes, and the spirit had held for us. But years later, with my own answer already in place, I asked my father, "Where did the ceremony come from? Did you learn it from your father and he from his? Did it stretch all the way back to the time of the canoes?" He thought for a long time. "No, I don't think so. It's just what we did. It seemed right." That was all. Some weeks went by, though, and when we spoke again, he said, "I've been thinking about the coffee and how we started giving it to the ground. You know, it was boiled coffee, There's no filter, and if it boils too hard, the grounds foam up and get stuck in the spout, so the first cup you pour would get that plug of grounds and be spoiled. I think we first did it to clear the spout. It was as if he'd told me that the water didn't change to wine. The whole web of gratitude, the whole story of remembrance, was nothing more than the dumping of the grounds. But you know, he said, there weren't always grounds to clear. It started out that way, but it became something else, a thought. It was a kind of respect, a kind of thanks. On a beautiful summer morning, I suppose you could call it joy. That, I think, is the power of ceremony. It marries the mundane to the sacred. The water turns to wine, the coffee to a prayer. The material and the spiritual mingle like grounds mingled with humus, transformed like steam rising from a mug into the morning mist. What else can you offer the earth, which has everything? What else can you give but something of yourself? A homemade ceremony. A ceremony that makes a home. Asters and goldenrod. The girl in the picture holds a slate with her name and class of 75 chalked in. A girl the color of deerskin, with long dark hair and inky, unreadable eyes that meet yours and won't look away. I remember that day. I was wearing the new plaid shirt that my parents had given me, an outfit I thought to be the hallmark of all foresters. When I looked back at the photo later in life, it was a puzzle to me. I recall being elated to be going to college, but there's no trace of that in the girl's face. Even before I arrived at school, I had all my answers prepared for the freshman intake interview. I wanted to make a good first impression. There were hardly any women at the forestry school in those days, and certainly none who looked like me. The advisor peered at me over his glasses and said, "So, why do you want to major in botany?" His pencil was poised over the registrar's form. How could I answer? How could I tell him that I was born a botanist? That I had shoeboxes of seeds and piles of pressed leaves under my bed, that I'd stopped my bike along the road to identify a new species, that plants colored my dreams, that the plants had chosen me. So I told him the truth. I was proud of my well-planned answer, its freshman sophistication apparent to anyone, the way I showed that I already knew some plants and their habitats, that I'd thought deeply about their nature, and was clearly well prepared for college work. I told him that I chose botany because I wanted to learn why asters and goldenrod look so beautiful together. I'm sure I was smiling then in my red plaid shirt. But he was not. He laid down his pencil as if there was no need to record what I had said. "Miss Wall," he said, fixing me with a disappointed smile, "I must tell you that that is not science. That is not at all the sort of thing with which botanists concern themselves." But he promised to put me right. "I'll enroll you in general botany so you can learn what it is." And so it began. I like to imagine that they were the first flowers I saw over my mother's shoulder as the pink blanket slipped away from my face and their colors flooded my consciousness. I've heard that early experience can attune the brain to certain stimuli so that they are processed with greater speed and certainty, so that they can be used again and again, so that we remember. Love at first sight. Through cloudy newborn eyes, their radiance formed the first botanical synapses in my wide-awake newborn brain, which until then had encountered only the blurry gentleness of pink faces. I'm guessing all eyes were on me, a little round baby, all swaddled in bunting, but mine were on goldenrod and asters. I was born to these flowers, and they came back for my birthday every year, weaving me into our mutual celebration. People flocked to our hills for the fiery sweet of October, but they often miss the sublime prelude of September fields. As if harvest time were not enough, peaches, grapes, sweet corn, squash, the fields are also embroidered with drifts of golden yellow and pools of deepest purple. A masterpiece. If a fountain could jet bouquets of chrome yellow and dazzling arches of chrysanthemum fireworks, that would be Canada goldenrod. Each 3-foot stem is a geyser of tiny gold daisies, ladylike in miniature, exuberant in mass. Where the soil is damp enough, they stand side by side with their perfect counterpart, New England asters. Not the pale domesticates of the perennial border, the weak sauce of lavender or sky blue, but full-on royal purple that would make a violet shrink. The daisy-like fringe of purple petals surrounds a disk as bright as the sun at high noon, a golden-orange pool, just a tantalizing shade darker than the surrounding goldenrod. Alone, each is a botanical superlative. Together, the visual effect is stunning. Purple and gold, the heraldic colors of the king and queen of the meadow, a regal procession in complementary colors. I just wanted to know why. Why do they stand beside each other when they could grow alone? Why this particular pair? There are plenty of pinks and whites and blues dotting the fields. So is it only happenstance that the magnificence of purple and gold end up side by side? Einstein himself said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. What is the source of this pattern? Why is the world so beautiful? It could so easily be otherwise. Flowers could be ugly to us and still fulfill their own purpose. But they're not. It seemed like a good question to me. But my advisor said, it's not science. Not what botany was about. I wanted to know why certain stems bent easily for baskets and some would break, why the biggest berries grew in the shade, and why they made us medicines, which plants are edible, why those little pink orchids only grow under pines. Not science, he said. And he ought to know, sitting in his laboratory, a learned professor of botany. And if you want to study beauty, you should go to art school. He reminded me of my deliberations over choosing a college when I had vacillated between training as a botanist or as a poet. Since everybody told me I couldn't do both, I'd chosen plants. He told me that science was not about beauty, not about the embrace between plants and humans. I had no rejoinder. I had made a mistake. There was no fight in me, only embarrassment at my error. I didn't have the words for resistance. He signed me up for my classes, and I was dismissed to go get my photo taken for registration. I didn't think about it at the time, but it was happening all over again. An echo of my grandfather's first day at school, when he was ordered to leave everything, language, culture, family, behind. The professor made me doubt where I came from, what I knew, and claimed that his was the right way to think. Only he didn't cut my hair off. In moving from a childhood in the woods to the university, I had unknowingly shifted between worldviews. From a natural history of experience, in which I knew plants as teachers and companions to whom I was linked with mutual responsibility, into the realm of science. The question science raised were not who are you, but what is it? No one asked plants, what can you tell us? The primary question was, how does it work? The botany I was taught was reductionist, mechanistic, and strictly objective. Plants were reduced to objects, they were not subjects. The way botany was conceived and taught didn't seem to leave much room for a person who thought the way I did. The only way I could make sense of it was to conclude that the things I had always believed about plants must not be true after all. That first plant science class was a disaster. I barely scraped by with a C and could not muster much enthusiasm for memorizing the concentrations of essential plant nutrients. There were times when I wanted to quit, but the more I learned, the more fascinated I became with the intricate structures that made up a leaf and the alchemy of photosynthesis. Companionship between asters and goldenrod was never mentioned, but I memorized botanical Latin as if it was poetry, eagerly tossing aside the name goldenrod for Solidago canadensis. I was mesmerized by plant ecology, evolution, taxonomy, physiology, soils, and fungi. All around me were my good teachers, the plants. I found good mentors, too, warm and kind professors who were doing heart-driven science, whether they could admit it or not. They, too, were my teachers. And yet there was always something tapping at my shoulder, willing me to turn around. When I did not know how to recognize what stood behind me. My natural inclination was to see relationships, to seek the threads that connect the world, to join instead of divide. But science is rigorous in separating the observer from the observed, and the observed from the observer. Why two flowers are beautiful together would violate the division necessary for objectivity. I scarcely doubted the primacy of scientific thought. Following the path of science trained me to separate, to distinguish perception from physical reality, to atomize complexity into its smallest components, to honor the chain of evidence and logic, to discern one thing from another, to savor the pleasure of precision. The more I did this, the better I got at it, and was accepted to do graduate work in one of the world's finest botany programs. No doubt on the strength of the letter of recommendation from my advisor, which read, "She's done remarkably well for an Indian girl." A master's degree, a PhD, and a faculty position followed. I am grateful for the knowledge that was shared with me and deeply privileged to carry the powerful tools of science as a way of engaging the world. It took me to other plant communities, far from the asters and goldenrod. I remember feeling, as a new faculty member, as if I finally understood plants. I, too, began to teach the mechanics of botany, emulating the approach that I had been taught. It reminds me of a story told by my friend Holly Youngbear Tibbetts. A plant scientist, armed with his notebooks and equipment, is exploring the rainforests for new botanical discoveries, and he has hired an indigenous guide to lead him. Knowing the scientist's interests, the young guide takes care to point out the interesting species. The botanist looks at him appraisingly, surprised by his capacity. "Well, well, young man, you certainly know the names of a lot of these plants." The guide nods and replies with downcast eyes, "Yes, I've learned the names of all the bushes, but I have yet to learn their songs." I was teaching the names and ignoring the songs. When I was in graduate school in Wisconsin, my then husband and I had the good fortune to land jobs as caretakers at the University Arboretum. In return for a little house at the edge of the prairie, we had only to make the nighttime rounds, checking that doors and gates were secure before we left the darkness to the crickets. There was just one time that a light was left burning, a door left ajar, in the horticulture garage. There was no mischief, but as my husband checked around, I stood and idly scanned the bulletin board. There was a news clipping there with a photo of a magnificent American elm which had just been named the champion for its species, the largest of its kind. It had a name, the Louisvieux elm. My heart began to pound, and I knew my world was about to change, for I'd known the name Louisvieux all my life, and here was his face looking at me from a news clipping. He was our Potawatomi grandfather, one who had walked all the way from the Wisconsin forests to the Kansas prairie with my grandma, Shanoda. He was a leader, one who took care of the people in their hardship. That garage door was left ajar. That light was left burning, and it shone on the path back home for me. It was the beginning of a long, slow journey back to my people, called out to me by the tree that stood above their bones. To walk the science path, I had stepped off the path of indigenous knowledge. But the world has a way of guiding your steps. Seemingly out of the blue came an invitation to a small gathering of native elders to talk about traditional knowledge of plants. One I will never forget, a Navajo woman, without a day of university botany training in her life, spoke for hours, and I hung on every word. One by one, name by name, she told of the plants in her valley, where each one lived, when it bloomed, who it liked to live near, and all of its relationships, who ate it, who lined their nests with its fibers, what kind of medicine it offered. She also shared the stories held by those plants, their origin myths, how they got their names, and what they have to tell us. She spoke of beauty. Her words were like smelling salts, waking me to what I had known back when I was picking strawberries. I realized how shallow my understanding was. Her knowledge was so much deeper and wider and engaged all the human ways of understanding. She could have explained asters and goldenrod. To a new PhD, this was humbling. It was the beginning of my reclaiming that other way of knowing that I had helplessly let science supplant. I felt like a malnourished refugee invited to a feast, the dishes scented with the herbs of home. I circled right back to where I had begun, to the question of beauty, back to the questions that science does not ask, not because they aren't important, but because science as a way of knowing is too narrow for the task. Had my advisor been a better scholar, he would have celebrated my questions, not dismissed them. He offered me only the cliché that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And since science separates the observer and the observed, by definition, beauty could not be a valid scientific question. I should have been told that my questions were bigger than science could touch. He was right about beauty being in the eye of the beholder, especially when it comes to purple and yellow. Color perception in humans relies on banks of specialized receptor cells, the rods and cones in the retina. The job of the cone cells is to absorb light of different wavelengths and pass it on to the brain's visual cortex, where it can be interpreted. The visible light spectrum, the rainbow of colors, is broad, so the most effective means of discerning color is not one generalized jack-of-all-trades cone cell, but rather an array of specialists, each perfectly tuned to absorb certain wavelengths. The human eye has three kinds. One type excels at detecting red and associated wavelengths. One is tuned to blue. The other optimally perceives light of two colors, purple and yellow. The human eye is superbly equipped to detect these colors and send a signal pulsing to the brain. This doesn't explain why I perceive them as beautiful, but it does explain why that combination gets my undivided attention. I asked my artist buddies about the power of purple and gold, and they sent me right to the color wheel. These two were complementary colors, as different in nature as could be. In composing a palette, putting them together makes each more vivid. Just a touch of one will bring out the other. In an 1890 treatise on color perception, Goethe, who was both a scientist and a poet, wrote that the colors diametrically opposed to each other are those which reciprocally evoke each other in the eye. Purple and yellow are a reciprocal pair. Our eyes are so sensitive to these wavelengths that the cones can get oversaturated and the stimulus pours over onto the other cells. A printmaker I know showed me that if you stare for a long time at a block of yellow and then shift your gaze to a white sheet of paper, you will see it for a moment as violet. This phenomenon, the colored afterimage, occurs because there is energetic reciprocity between purple and yellow pigments, which goldenrod and asters knew well before we did. If my advisor was correct, the visual effect that so delights a human like me may be irrelevant to the flowers. The real beholder whose eyes they hope to catch is a bee bent on pollination. Bees perceive many flowers differently than humans do, due to their perception of additional spectra, such as ultraviolet radiation. As it turns out, though, goldenrod and asters appear very similarly to bee eyes and human eyes. We both think they're beautiful. Their striking contrast when they grow together makes them the most attractive target in the whole meadow, a beacon for bees. Growing together, both receive more pollinator visits than they would if they were growing alone. It's a testable hypothesis. It's a question of science, a question of art, and a question of beauty. Why are they beautiful together? It is a phenomenon simultaneously material and spiritual, for which we need all wavelengths, for which we need depth perception. When I stare too long at the world with science eyes, I see an afterimage of traditional knowledge. Might science and traditional knowledge be purple and yellow to one another? Might they be goldenrod and asters? We see the world more fully when we use both. The question of goldenrod and asters was, of course, just emblematic of what I really wanted to know. It was an architecture of relationships, of connections, that I yearned to understand. I wanted to see the shimmering threads that hold it all together. And I wanted to know why we love the world. Why the most ordinary scrap of meadow can rock us back on our heels in awe. When botanists go walking the forests and fields looking for plants, we say they are going on a foray. When writers do the same, we should call it a metaphoray, and the land is rich in both. We need them both. Scientist and poet Geoffrey Burton Russell writes that as the sign of a deeper truth, metaphor was close to sacrament, because the vastness and richness of reality cannot be expressed by the overt sense of a statement alone. Native scholar Greg Cahete has written that in indigenous ways of knowing, we understand a thing only when we understand it with all four aspects of our being, mind, body, emotion, and spirit. I came to understand quite sharply when I began my training as a scientist that science privileges only one, possibly two, of those ways of knowing, mind and body. As a young person wanting to know everything about plants, I did not question this. But it is a whole human being who finds the beautiful path. There was a time when I teetered precariously with an awkward foot in each of two worlds, the scientific and the indigenous. But then I learned to fly, or at least try. It was the bees that showed me how to move between different flowers, to drink the nectar and gather pollen from both. It is this dance of cross-pollination that can produce a new species of knowledge, a new way of being in the world. After all, there aren't two worlds. There is just this one good green earth. That September pairing of purple and gold is lived reciprocity. Its wisdom is that the beauty of one is illuminated by the radiance of the other. Science and art, matter and spirit, indigenous knowledge and Western science. Can they be goldenrod and asters for each other? When I am in their presence, their beauty asks me for reciprocity, to be the complementary color, to make something beautiful in response.